when I came back from Romania, where my parents had been missionaries for about 5 years, I moved back to Southern California to attend college. And Southern California and Romania are very different places in a lot of ways. But one of the ways is in where we lived in Romania, as is the case in Grand Rapids, you don't have to go very far before you find nature. And that was always something that I really enjoyed. And so when I came back to Southern California, I realized after about 6 months that it had been 6 full months since I had seen any sort of open space that wasn't paved over. And so I started to get a little bit of a, like almost a claustrophobic sense. And so I just got in my car one Sunday after church and I just started driving. I knew not to drive towards the ocean because there's nothing but pavement between where I was and the ocean. So I drove east. And it took a solid 45 minutes without traffic before I started to see open spaces. And there are these foothills that ring Orange County. And so I started to drive up into those foothills and I reached a point where you could look out and you could see almost the entirety of Central Orange County. Well, you would have been able to see Central Orange County, except that all that I could see was this dense, brown, soupy yuck. I couldn't see buildings. I was a solid 700-800 feet up. I could see the ocean, or at least what was on top of the ocean. It was this layer of smoggy haze. And I looked down on that, and I thought, I know there's a city filled with 1 million people, right? And I can't see any of it. And then I started to think, and I thought, I just came out of that. I was breathing that. And so when I went back down, I looked up at the sky, which I had lost the habit of doing, and I started to realize that the sky isn't blue in Southern California. It looks kind of blue, but it's actually kind of this really dim, very light, bluey, browny, and you just get used to it. So when we came to West Michigan, I said, wow, this is what a sky is supposed to look like. This is what clean air feels like. And the smog in California is nothing like what it was when my dad was growing up. They tell stories about when you could see the smog at the end of the street. So that's gotten better. I'm told that God did not intend for any group of human beings to inhabit the place that is now LA and Orange County because any amount of smoke makes this dense haze, and it only goes away when the Santa Anas come through and blow it all out to sea, and then you go, oh, that's blue sky. But so often we are confronted with a reality that is toxic to us. We don't even realize it. We just take it for granted that this is normal. This is the way things are supposed to be. It's true with our physical environment if we don't get out much. It is even more true of our spiritual environment. The environment that we live in as well as the one that we create for ourselves. And so as we continue in the book of Judges, the Israelites are creating and finding themselves in a toxic spiritual environment of their own making. And we're going to see this morning that they don't even realize that it's there. So we're coming to the last of our judges, 12 or 13 depending on the count. And possibly the most famous of the set, Samson. We're going to be talking about Samson this week and next week. There's a lot here. Judges 13, beginning verse 1. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. We've been talking about this cycle. I invite you as we read through this to see if you can by now, as I hope you should, be able to see the elements of the cycle. You may find some interesting things along the way this morning. People of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, so Yahweh gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. That statement is a common one in Scripture, and already, because we know the stories of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, of barren women who have given birth, we expect that something is about to be said to Manoah, the father, the husband, about a child coming. We're primed. We've read the Old Testament. We know what happens to barren women. They give birth. It's so common, in fact, that we read barren almost as a promise that a child's going to come. Because God so often is in the business of doing this, and we expect that something will be said to Manoah. Look at verse 3. And the angel of Yahweh appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore, be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." The angel appears to this woman who throughout the narrative remains nameless. The same angel of Yahweh that appeared to Joshua. The same one that appeared in the second chapter of Judges and told the Israelites why they were in the fix that they were in. Doesn't come to Manoah, comes to the woman. Tells her what she already knows. You've been barren and have no children, but you're going to conceive and give birth to a son. And not just any son. This son, from the day of his birth, is going to take upon himself a vow of a Nazarite. In Numbers 6, the Israelites were given this vow. It was an opportunity for those who were not of the priestly tribe of Levi to be dedicated as servants to God. And usually it was for a term. It was something that someone would choose as an adult to take on for a term. The Apostle Paul did this. We don't know for how long, but for a season. And at the end of the vow, when the vow was completed, when he had fulfilled what he had sworn to God that he would do, then and only then did the Apostle Paul cut his hair. That was the sign that a Nazarite's vow was completed, was when they got their next haircut. Part of the vow was not to cut your hair during the time of the vow. And this young boy from birth will be a Nazarite. That is unusual. And later on we read that the vow is meant to last his entire life until his death. He's not to drink any wine or alcoholic beverage during the time of his vow. So that's his entire life. His mother is held to the same standard. And he's to eat nothing unclean. He's to follow scrupulously all of the dietary laws of the Israelites. And most importantly, he's not to touch any dead bodies. Those are the components of a Nazarite vow. And the reason is because he is going to be devoted from birth to a task. He will begin. And I would circle that word. He will begin to save the Israelites from the hand of the Philistines. Well, the woman does what I think any wife would do under such circumstances. She went home and told her husband. And Manoah's response is interesting. There's a seed of doubt. Because his response is to pray to the Lord and to say, "Can you have the angel come back and talk to me?" It's all well and good that he spoke to my wife, but surely you want to talk to me. And the God who hears, in verse 9, listens to Manoah's voice, and the angel of God comes again to the woman. Manoah asks, "Can you send the angel to me?" And God sends the angel again to his wife. I think God's trying to tell us something. And so the wife runs quickly and gets her husband. Okay, he's back. So Manoah comes and says, "So this child, what are we supposed to do with him?" As though his wife hasn't already related to him everything the angel said. And the angel doesn't add anything to it when he says to Manoah, "Well, he's going to be a Nazarite, and he's got to not drink wine and not cut his hair, and you know, everything I told your wife that your wife told you." So verse 15, Manoah, you can sense he's trying to put himself in charge of this situation. He says he wants to offer a sacrifice. He thinks this is a divine being that he's speaking with. And the angel says, "If you're going to offer a sacrifice, fine, but offer it to God, not to me." So then Manoah says, "Well, what is your name?" He's trying to get a handle on this. Asking someone their name was a way of asserting control, especially if it was a divine being. If you knew the divine being's name, you could invoke that name and you could put them in your debt. In a polytheistic pagan culture, Manoah is trying to get control over this situation. He's not happy that his wife is the one to whom the angel has come twice. He wants to offer a sacrifice because that's how you put pagan gods in your debt. He wants to know this angel's name, and the angel keeps kind of just, you know, doing the Heisman maneuver, just, you know, stop it. You're not going to get me under your grip. And so finally, he says, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? They offer the sacrifice, and in the smoke, the angel ascends back to heaven. And then, verse 21, Manoah knew that he was the angel of Yahweh. And his response is to say, we're going to die. We've seen God's messenger. We're going to die. And his wife says, no, we're not. If he was going to kill us, he would have done it already. We're going to have a son. He's got a job. He's not going to kill us. All of this to say that if we're going to make any sense of what follows, this whole chapter is devoted to this birth announcement. Mother knew best. Mother had spiritual insight into what was going on. Mother was the one to which God sent the angel. Manoah consistently refused to get the point. And so the story of Samson begins with his parents being deaf to his call. They didn't understand what it was that God was presenting to him. They were deaf to his call as a Nazirite. And even so, she gives birth, she names him Samson, and it says that the Lord blessed him, he began to grow, and then this interesting phrase in verse 25, the Spirit of Yahweh began to stir him in Mahena Dan, the camp of Dan, where the troops of Dan would have been gathered, between his home of Zorah and Eshtaol. It's an auspicious beginning, although there's these questions about particularly his father. But Samson, from the very beginning, he's going to be a Nazirite dedicated to God's service. He has the Spirit of God stirring him, and Yahweh is blessing him, and he's growing. And in the background, we read this promise, he will begin to deliver the Israelites from the Philistines. So what next? Well, Samson, in verse 1 of chapter 14, goes down to Timnah. And at Timnah, he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Verbs of seeing are going to be very important in this chapter. Then he came up and told his father and mother. We're not going to read this entire chapter. I would invite you to go back, though, at some point. Read through the chapter. Underline every time his father and mother are mentioned together. And then compare when only one parent is mentioned. He came up and told his father and mother, I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. He sees something he wants. He insists on having it, and he goes to his father and mother and says, get her for me. But his father and mother said to him, is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you must go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? They object to his choice of a mate. In this culture, it would have fallen to them usually to try to choose a mate for him. He wouldn't necessarily bring candidates for them to approve. But their reasoning is not what we would expect the reasoning to be. The danger in this match is that as a Philistine, she is devoted to false gods and idols. But that's not what they say. They say she's not family. She's not from our tribe. They see something wrong, but it's not quite the right wrong. And so note in verse 3, but Samson said to his father. He initially comes to mom and dad. And you get the impression that maybe it wasn't dad that said, aren't you sure you can't find someone among our relatives? That maybe that was mom recognizing something, because he says to his father, get her for me, for she is right in my eyes. That phrase is going to be a haunting phrase in the last five chapters of the book of Judges. It's going to come up over and over again that the Israelites in those days, every one of them did what was right in their eyes. And the reason is because they had no king. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And here we have he who is supposed to begin to deliver his people from the Philistines saying, get her for me. She is right in my eyes. Verse 4, his father and mother did not know that it was from Yahweh, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. And to remind us, at that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. Well, what now unfolds is that his dad goes along with this plan, goes down and arranges for this woman to be his son's wife. Dad arranges for the wedding feast. And the wedding feast takes place, and the Philistines give Samson 30 companions, 30 groomsmen, basically. They're putting on this feast, and his father's made these arrangements. And Samson, in the midst of the feast, tells a riddle. And the riddle is based on something that happened to him as he was going to the wedding. This lion had charged out of nowhere and come at him. And the text says that the Spirit of Yahweh rushed upon him. The verb there is something that is said of forceful entry. It's coming in against the will of the person. The Spirit of God forced its way, his way, into Samson. And Samson is able to rip the lion limb from limb in the midst of its attack. There's a hint that perhaps God is trying to alert Samson that his way is perilous. Well, Samson passed by that same lion's carcass later on, and there was a hive of bees that had made honey in the carcass of the lion. Strange, unusual, and Samson, in violation of his vow, goes and scoops out some of the honey and eats it. And so he presents this riddle based on this encounter to his groomsmen and says, out of the strong, something sweet, out of the eater, something to eat. And they can't figure it out. And he's made this a wager where they're going to have to fork over 30 changes of clothes if they can't figure out his riddle. Well, after 3 days, they can't figure it out, so they go to his wife. And they say, listen, your husband's making fools out of all of us. What's the answer to the riddle? And she says, he hasn't told me. And they say, well, you better figure it out. If you don't tell us the answer to this riddle, we're going to burn your house to the ground, kill your family. So she goes to Samson. She pleads with him and begs him. So he finally caves in and tells her the answer to the riddle. She runs to her people, tells them the answer to the riddle. And the answer to the riddle is in verse 18. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? Now, you couldn't have come up with that answer on your own. There's no logical path to get to that answer. But the answer isn't actually the answer. What is sweeter than honey and at the same time stronger than a lion? There's something here significant for Samson that's just been exposed. Samson is the strong man, the one who can rip a lion limb from limb. But what proved stronger than him that was at the same time sweet? It was this woman. It was this emotional draw that he felt that he could not subdue, and he knows it. He knows what undid him because his answer to them is, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. And this is why we don't want to ascribe the word love to what Samson is feeling. That statement is just as insulting in an ancient context as it is in ours. To call a woman a cow is insulting in any context at any time. He does not have anything like sincere love for his bride. And so he's upset. He lost his wager. They figured out the riddle by convincing his wife to betray his trust. And what happens next is the Spirit of Yahweh again rushes upon him. Samson has more encounters with the Spirit of God than any of the other judges. All of them with this phrase, rushed upon him. And so he goes down and he kills 30 Philistines, takes their clothes, and gives them in payment of the wager that he lost. Then he goes back to his dad's house, and his wife's father gives her to somebody else. Samson is blind to the danger. He's deaf to his call. He ignores his vow, and he's blind to the danger the Philistines pose. The Philistines are the ones that God has used to punish his people, and Samson wants to become one of them, wants to marry into that. And he's blind to the danger. He does not see the danger that he is in. What is right in his eyes is toxic and deadly. But he plunges headlong into it. But all of this, we're told, is from the Lord, who's seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. If you ever figure out how that works, be sure to let me know. But it's the first time that Samson has acted in violence towards the Philistines, and it's in response to this foolish wager he shouldn't have made in the first place, at a marriage he shouldn't have been at. But it serves as an opportunity. So a while later, chapter 15, the story continues. And Samson, it means to go down and see his wife, which is normal. I remember my brother was asked by someone before he got married, so after you guys get married, are you going to live together? Yeah, we're going to do the whole thing. We're going to get married and live together. You know, the whole, we just figure we'll do the whole thing all at once, you know. Not sure why the person asked that, but it's assumed. And so Samson goes down to stay with his wife, not realizing that her dad gave her away to somebody else. And he says, well, I was sure you hated her after calling her a cow in public and everything and then killing 30 of our best friends to pay a debt. I was sure you hated her. You can have her younger sister if you want. So Samson, again, enraged, goes out and he gets 300 foxes, ties their tails together, ties torches between each of their tails and sets them loose in the midst of the Philistines' farm fields, burns their crops to the ground. More than economic loss, this jeopardizes the survival of the community. Their crops for the year are destroyed. This is not just vandalism. This is an act of war. So the Philistines ask, well, who did this? And they say, well, Samson, the son-in-law of the guy from Timnah. So the Philistines go up to Samson's ex-wife's house and do what they had threatened to do to her in the first place. They kill her family, burn their house to the ground. Now Samson's mad again and goes out and attacks and kills some more Philistines. The text says he struck them hip and thigh. And then he runs away. The Philistines come looking for him. They come to the tribe of Judah, in which Samson has gone as a fugitive. And they say to the men of Judah, where's Samson? We want him. And so the tribe of Judah, the one that was supposed to take the lead in delivering the Israelites from the Canaanites, if you remember all the way back at the beginning of the chapter, they now go and help the Philistines find the one that was to begin to deliver the Israelites from the Philistines. 3,000 men of Judah go up, not to make war against the Philistines, but to find Samson. And they call out to Samson, who's hiding in this cleft of a rock, and they say, the Philistines are here, and we'd like to hand you over to them, please. It's interesting, they ask Samson. His strength is legendary. And Samson says, as long as you don't kill me, I'll come out. If all you're going to do is hand me over to the Philistines, well and good. They say, yeah, no, we're not going to kill you. We're just going to hand them over to them. They're probably going to kill you, but no, we won't. So they bind him up with two fresh new ropes. They bring him out to the Philistines, and the Spirit of Yahweh rushes upon him. He snaps the ropes like so much string, picks up a jawbone of a donkey, the preferred weapon of combat in any setting, and proceeds to slaughter 1,000 Philistines with it. And in verse 16, he says, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men. It's not quite the hymn of praise that Deborah and Barak sang upon having liberated the Israelites from their enemies back in chapter 5. This is essentially an end zone celebration dance, drawing glory and praise to what he has just done in the simplest and most brutal of language. As soon as he had finished speaking, he threw away the jawbone out of his hand, and that place was called Ramath Lehi. And he was very thirsty, and he called upon Yahweh and said, you've granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant, and shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? And God split open the hollow place that is at Lehi, and water came out from it. And when he drank, his spirit returned, and he revived Therefore, the name of it was called En-Hakkore. It is at Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Samson is deaf to his call. He is blind to the dangers around him. And he's thirsty. For what? It's easy to say he's thirsty for vengeance. That's what motivates him at every turn. The Philistines have done something to him, and he goes out and kills a lot of them and feels better afterwards. What's he really thirsty for? You may have missed some elements of our cycle as we went through the story. You recall that there is this cyclical pattern in the book of Judges. It begins with the people of Israel again doing what is evil in the sight of Yahweh, which means doing what is right in their own sight. And Yahweh hands them over to be delivered into the hands of their enemies. And does anyone remember what the next step has been up until now? It's a real question. They cry out. Did you notice? They don't. They're in the hands of the strongest of the inhabitants of the land for the longest duration up to this point in the book. Their oppression should feel stronger than at any given time. And the text does not say that at any point they cried out to Yahweh. It's entirely missing, if we can put that slide up. They don't cry out. It skips right past that to God sending the angel to Manoah's wife. They don't cry out. They're not asking for deliverance. And when Samson begins, in his own haphazard idiom, to try to deliver them without trying to deliver them, they actually try to take him prisoner and hand him over to their oppressors. They are in league with their oppressors. When the people of Israel typically cry out, if we can put that up there, the response is usually that God raises up a judge. It's been a while since God has raised up a judge in the book of Judges. You'll recall he didn't raise up Jephthah. He was elected democratically. The text tells us that Yahweh is seeking an opportunity against the Philistines, which leaves the question that the Israelites aren't. They're content. They're fine. And so is their supposed deliverer. He's so comfortable with the Philistine occupation that he wants to marry in. He's deaf to the call that his life from the beginning was supposed to be about delivering the Israelites from oppression. He's blind to the dangers of those who are oppressing them. And I think it's because he's thirsty. Because at the end of this passage, his thirst for vengeance has surely been quenched. And he has this physical thirst, and it's the first time in this entire chapter that anyone has cried out to God. He says, God, I'm thirsty. I've done so much for you. You're going to let me die of thirst now? And God, in his graciousness, the God who hears, and did you notice this, that more than in any other story in the book of Judges, God responds to his people. Even when they're not crying out, even when they're not knowing of their need, he responds. And he gives Samson what Samson asked for, water. It says that Samson's spirit was refreshed and he felt better. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines. Did you catch that? He only began to deliver them. They're still, at the end of everything Samson has done, they're still under the yoke of the Philistines. So now what? Here's the thing that sobers me about Samson's story. He really doesn't encounter any hardship or difficulty. At the end of chapter 15, he can reflect back on what has come and say, I'm doing fine. I have had victory in every instance where I have entered into combat. I have my strength. No one can stop me. God seems to be pleased with me even because when I asked him for water, he did a miracle for me. I'm doing just fine. Because he doesn't understand that what he is actually thirsty for is the one thing he hasn't asked for, which is the presence of God in his life. It sobers me to think that the circumstances of our lives can be basically fine. We can be comfortable. Everything's going well. We have security and stability and significant relationships, and the kids are all right. Our world is ordered. We have mild winter and a long, beautiful summer and a luxurious fall, and it just feels like, man, life in West Michigan couldn't get much better than this. And we're in the greatest jeopardy that we could possibly be in. I know many of us have endured hardships and difficulties over the last year, and as I've talked with you and walked with you through those difficulties, it has awakened you to your true need, your need for God. And several of you have said to me, when this passes, I hope I still recognize how much I desperately need God. The difficulties serve to alert us to our true thirst and our true need. Philistine oppression should have made the Israelites aware of how far astray they had gone, how distant they were from God. And God in his mercy comes after them and comes after them and comes after them, and they're completely shut off to who he is. And it starts with their judge. They feel like everything's fine. There was a church in the New Testament that Jesus spoke to directly, the church in Laodicea. And Jesus said to this church, I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot. You're useless. Cold water is a blessing, hot water is a blessing. Lukewarm water is just nasty. Would that you were either cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. For you say, I am rich. If we're honest, so many of us can say that. I have prospered and I need nothing. That's what biblical wealth is, by the way. Knowing where your next meal is coming from, having a roof over your head, being able to say, I don't need anything. And so many of us are so far beyond that. Not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may be rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Now, Jesus has just told this church that because of their condition, he's about to spit them out of his mouth. The language is stronger than that. Look at verse 19. Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline, so be zealous and repent. Samson's problem, the Israelites' problem, all of our problems is that we don't realize the danger that we're in. We don't realize the glory of what we have been called to. Paul said it of himself, he said it of Timothy, and it is true of every follower of Jesus, that from birth we are set apart for God's service. And it's not even just true of every believer. Every human being, because of the image of God in us, is to be set apart for the service of God. We are called to something glorious, and we abandon it. We stop our ears to it. We would much rather tell our own stories and seek our own glory than work for God's good. And so we're blind to the dangers of such a course. And so then when we feel thirsty, when our souls that were created for God, and of which Augustine said that we'll never find satisfaction until we find it in him, we look for satisfaction in all the wrong places. We look for contentment everywhere but in the presence of God, and then wonder why we still feel thirsty. We are deaf, we're blind, and we are thirsty. And Jesus tells this church, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. About to. Those whom I love, I discipline. So be zealous and repent. Be shaken from your apathy. Here is the thing. This is not about trying harder. Trying harder is what Samson keeps doing. This is about crying out to the God who hears. This is about not trying harder, but neither being complacent. It is one thing to say, I am desperately in need of God and need him to fill every void. And crying out to him nonstop until we are satisfied in him. It is a whole other thing to say, I feel thirsty, I'm just going to try harder, run that treadmill, whatever that treadmill is, whether it's the treadmill of legalism, whether it's the treadmill of pleasure, whether it's the treadmill of fill in the blank. That's not what God wants of us. He wants us to come and buy gold from him. Economically speaking, that makes no sense. Come to him who longs to give us exactly what we need so that we will be rich, so that we will see, so we will no longer be naked. So this morning as we come to the table, that is exactly what Jesus invites us to. In John 6, he said, I am the bread that comes down out of heaven. I am what you most desperately need. And so whoever eats of my flesh and drinks of my blood, that's the one that will have eternal life. We are a thirsty people, whether we know it or not, and we come to the table not because we have everything that we need. We come to the table precisely because we have nothing that we need, and our gracious God prepares a banquet for us to feast upon.